I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Please note, season one of this podcast was recorded before the passing of our beautiful and brilliant TV mom, Suzanne Summers. Suzanne, we love you, we miss you, and this podcast is dedicated to you.
We're two stepsisters bonded, living Hollywood lives. Even if one of us is watching for the very first time, all the good, the bad, the barky, take a peek inside. Let's rewatch and relive the good times. Keep it and they can give you deja vu.
Hi. This is Keenan and Lakin Give You Deja Vu, the rewatch podcast where we will take turns breaking down every episode of the 90s sitcom Step by Step in order. I'm Christine Lakin, and I played Al Lambert.
I'm Stacey Keenan, and I played Dana Foster.
We're going to tell you how it really went down because
we were there.
And for Stacey, this is a first watch podcast.
That's right. Watching all of these episodes for the very first time.
Like you never even saw like a rerun?
Never.
Like you didn't even have something on a VHS and you decided I'll just pop it in real quick?
Nope.
Wow. Okay. First one. First time.
Here we go.
This is the 90s, everyone. We are currently going to delve in today into episode 2 of Step by Step. We are talking 1991 style. The first episode premiered in September, so this would be probably late September, early October, 1991.
Back to school time.
That's right. This episode is entitled The Dance.
The Dance.
Okay. Should we just roll right into this?
Let's roll.
Because there were so many fashion faux pas, I like can't wait to get started on this episode.
This was a colorful episode, literally, yes. And I don't know, figuratively, I guess, in terms of the wardrobe.
For sure.
Everybody.
Woo. Okay, so we start off at this episode. The Lambert family and the Foster family are outside in the backyard. They're having a little backyard barbecue for dinner. Now, as you might have remembered in the first episode, it was all about setting up that these two families were coming together. This is sort of the redux of the Brady Bunch, but the kids hate each other. The stars are Patrick Duffy and Suzanne Summers, and they kind of fall in love and want their life to be sort of hunky-dory because they're totally madly hot for each other, can't stop kissing.
Constantly making out.
This is like TGIF. If you were a kid or even like a young adult in the 90s, you remember TGIF. So this is the second episode. So we're still laying the pipe for this family. We're still getting to know that they don't like each other and all of the relationships are starting to evolve.
Yes. So the parents are madly in love, but they're different people. There's a little bit of an odd couple situation. And because of that, their kids are at odds. So how is this going to work is, I guess, the question of the show.
So we start off, we're in the backyard. Dana is sitting there in a really, in my mind, kind of confusing outfit. It is a red bodysuit with a overall.
The overalls, man.
And a red scrunchie. So this is one more time in an overall. I think this might be the last time we see you. I feel like after episode two, you were like, listen, the show got picked up. I am not doing overalls anymore. We need to rethink this whole thing. Okay. It was fine for the pilot, but now we're picked up for at least six. So no more overalls.
Listen, we're picked up. We got that network money. It is time to do some tailoring, people, because these overalls are not going to work.
I know for a fact that you rented out Magic Mountain. I know how much that was to make these titles. Don't be telling me you don't have a budget for a nice blouse, okay?
Well, and as we're going to see, as the season goes along, the wardrobe starts to teach us who the characters are a little more, I find.
I agree.
By episode three, which is the next one that I happen to watch, but haven't watched anymore, the characters are being kind of taught to us very clearly in the wardrobe, which wasn't like Dana wearing overalls told us nothing. Who is she? I don't know. She's just a generic teenager. But we get more into the Dana is kind of edgy. Dana is smart. Dana has a lot of critique of everything going on. And she's, I guess, you know, kind of not bookish, but I don't know.
Like an intellectual.
Yeah. Or an achiever, or wants to be that. Mm-hmm. And so her look starts to convey that. And all the characters start to do that more.
Yeah. So basically we got out of the gap. Everybody got out of the gap.
Yes, thank God.
Except for Al, who continues to wear the gap for many seasons.
Poor Al. There's some looks here.
We'll get there.
But some good ones too.
Some good ones too. So Frank is making hot dogs. He says to JT, how many dogs? And JT looks at Dana and Karen and says, well, Dana, Karen, I count two, Dad.
Spicy.
Burn. Ooh, burn. And Mark is standing there and Mark says something about to the effect of, I couldn't possibly eat. I'm just too nervous because my science fair partner is coming in town to work on a project with me. And I've never met, but you know, we've communicated by computer modem and the occasional fax. This is like a pre-internet joke, guys. This is like we were not really even into AOL. You've got mail.
Barely. No. I mean, you had to be a real hardcore computer person, I think, at this point to be online. I mean, I remember thinking, oh, I that's too intimidating. I'm not, you know, a hacker or a computer programmer. How could I possibly use the internet?
This isn't the net. Sandy Bullock, that hasn't even come out yet. I mean.
Right. So computer modem, that was pretty advanced. And it's telling us who Mark is, right? He's the youngest foster kid. He's
a mini Bill Gates.
Yes, he's smart. He's a little nerdy. Well, he's a lot nerdy. And he is very school oriented.
I used to fax my friends, by the way. Well, like when I was filming the show, because, you know, as a lot of people may not know this. So when I booked this show, I lived in Atlanta, Georgia. And this was like a real fluke that I came out and auditioned for this thing, got the pilot. They still wanted me. And my mom was like, oh no, we got picked up.
Because by the way, for what Christine is referring to there, for those of you who don't know, you might be in the pilot and then you might not be in the show.
Yeah,
that happens
a lot.
Where the network approves of the casting of a certain person and then they, you know, the pilot is made and the show gets picked up. And then maybe they do some testing on that pilot with some audiences. Or maybe you just have one particular executive who just is not feeling you. And they may say, yeah, producers will pick up your show, but that character is going to get recast. And there's lots of sad stories like that.
I know. And you see sort of sometimes the difference between the pilot and the rest of the series. Like, for instance, there was a different Mark. There was a different character who played Mark in the pilot that we shot. And then we had to go back and reshoot scenes in the pilot,
That's
which
right.
I don't remember doing.
Yes, there was a different actor.
His name was Jarrett Lennon.
Yes, sweet kid.
Very sweet kid, who I actually had on my other podcast.
I saw that. I listened to that episode because I wanted to hear how he was doing and what was
everything
going
from
on.
His perspective. He is such a nice guy and is like not really in the business as much anymore, but is just so well adjusted and told the whole story in such a, you know, just a frank and honest way. He basically got the pilot, played the character, and then this is just like Hollywood, guys. Then afterwards, you know, they picked up the show and we had these like pickup parties and for ABC, and they would take place at these fancy hotels, and all of the Hollywood foreign press and different outlets would come, and they would sort of interview the stars, and you would mingle and eat shrimp. And it was, you know, as you're a kid, you're just like, I'm going to a party. Great. So he tells the story like this. He gets to the party because I guess they had gotten the invitation and they had already RSVP'd. They get to the party and they're in the elevator with Chris Castile and his mother.
And they're like, oh, wow.
And he's like, hey, and they used to see each other all the time at auditions.
Except blonde.
Right. So they knew each other pretty well. And he goes, oh, hey, Jared, it's great to see you. And Jared goes, oh, yeah, you too, Chris. What are you doing here? Oh, I got cast on this show. Oh, really? What show is it? It's called Step by Step. Hold on. That's the show I'm in. Yeah. They didn't bother to tell Jared. And they found out at the party.
That is so Hollywood, everyone. Look, now that I've left the industry, I look back on stories just like this, which are very commonplace, of exactly this kind of treatment of people.
Yeah.
And by the way, we worked for some of the nicest people in the industry. They were extremely nice. So I don't blame them for this.
No, I think the manager just decided not to tell them or didn't. There was some lapse in communication with someone who was too afraid to say the truth.
Yes. And not the producers of the show, because they were very nice people, but someone else made that decision. But these things happen all the time. But my point is, looking at the industry now from the outside, I just think, no wonder this is considered to be Sodom and Gomorrah over here. What other industry could you treat people like this and not ruin your reputation, damage your image in the industry? I mean, if you're in the, I don't know, automotive industry, can you treat people like that? It just doesn't happen.
In the elevator and you're like, hey, Sandy. No. Oh, hey, Lisa. Yeah, no. I just got this vice president position. Oh, that's weird. That's my title too.
Come on. I mean,
odd. Wait, are we walking to the same office? Hold on. You took my name off the wall? Like, no.
Jesus.
No, it doesn't happen like that.
No. And you know, I'm in the law field where everything is your reputation.
Right.
And anyway.
Well, so yeah, it was definitely an awkward moment for them. Jared, he has such a great like memory of it, because he sort of was like, it was definitely awkward at the time, but like Chris felt so bad about it and like didn't really know how to handle it. And of course not. They were like 10 years old.
Yeah. I wouldn't know how to handle that now.
But he was sort of like, oh, well, okay. You know, he was sort of, he really handled it well. But anyway, the interesting thing is, because they had spent so much money, as we previously talked about Magic Mountain, they didn't decide to redo all of those titles. So for the next 8 years, there is a couple of moments in the beginning of those title sequences, and it's still Jarrett Lennon. They never replaced him with Chris. They just replaced, not in the big wide shots. Like his face is still very visible.
Yeah. I mean, now they could probably go in and kind of CGI in a little blonde toupee.
Totally.
On top of Jarrett's head.
But like that wasn't happening.
That wasn't happening then. Yeah. That almost happened to me on My Two Dads, a show, an even older show that I did in the 80s, when I'm sure some of you were not even born. But yeah, they almost replaced me after the pilot.
For real?
Yeah. It was a really long process for them to even cast me. I mean, they saw Drew Barrymore. They saw Juliette Lewis. They saw so many people, hundreds of girls in New York and in LA. And the producer was sold on me, but the network was like, we don't really love her. And she looks too old, because I was supposed to be 12 and they thought that I looked kind of almost like a teenager.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I'm only 5'3", but I was 5'3" then.
Right.
And just kind of the same size or whatever. And they were like, no, she doesn't. They wanted someone who looked younger and smaller. And they just didn't think that I was very charismatic or funny or compelling. They were just like, eh, like, what do you see? You created this character or whatever, but what do you see in her? Like, they just didn't get it, and they weren't that enthused. So they did the pilot with me, and then they saw a bunch of other people, and they were trying to recast me, which at that age, I didn't care. If that had happened to me later in life, I would have been devastated, but I was just like, all right, well, okay. But then the creator of the show just, he's a feisty, spicy firecracker, and he insisted they keep me, and so they did. And then eventually I got a note, one of those notes you hear about from Warren Littlefield saying, you know, I had my doubts, but you were the right one all along.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Crow, dig in. Wow, that's a crazy story. I've been fired a couple times. We'll talk about that.
You're not we'll alone. Me too.
Okay. So anyway, getting back to Step by Step, they are a highly anticipated, waiting for this person to arrive, this science fair partner. Carol, Suzanne Summers, comes out with a big bowl of potato salad, which, by the way, looked like she got it from Ralph's. It wasn't even in a bowl. It was in some like strange sort of plastic catering package, which is so odd. But she's, of course, wearing blue jeans and a blue Henley. We're back into the blue theme where everyone wears blue on the show. And what happens at the end of the cold open? A big crash on top of the picnic table. The family jumps up and this person lands in the middle of the picnic table. He was flying a jetpack.
He destroys the potato salad.
Destroys the potato salad, the entire barbecue, stands up and says the famous line, "Did I do that?" And that's right, friends, it's Julia White as Urkel. This is the great crossover episode of Family Matters and Step by Step.
Yes, where they were, somebody, the network is saying, is anyone going to watch this brand new show? We need to get an established character who's a breakout character from one of the other shows in this lineup. Get him over here to get people to tune into this new thing.
Yeah. We go through the titles and we are now into the show. One thing my mom said, which I didn't really think about, like I was telling her what we were talking about with the titles and all the like the different things and how we couldn't ride the rides except for that one ride that was like the splashdown ride. And she goes, "Oh yeah. And you can see Suzanne standing on the box." I went, "What are you talking about standing on the box?" She said, "When you come down the chute and you're in that boat, and the camera's behind her and Patrick, and there you see the water like shooting up, she's standing on an apple box because she was so short and they really wanted her and Patrick to be the same height when they got wet."
Oh.
And you can see it. You don't really know what it is unless you're in the industry and you know that she's standing on an apple box.
Oh, I never noticed that.
Yeah. These are all the things that, you know, all the mistakes, I guess, the hidden things that I never even thought of.
And Suzanne is not short. She's just not as tall as Patrick. Yeah. Patrick's probably 6 feet or more.
Yeah.
And Suzanne is about 5'6", maybe 5'5".
And I think this made them just more even. So when, you know, they got hit in the face with all that water, it was...
Wow. Eagle eye on your mom.
I know. My mom used to love catching all the mistakes. Okay, so now we're into the show. We have Urkel and Mark, and they're talking about their project they're going to do on like nuclear fission, and little cute Brendan is trailing behind them. Carol is at the fridge, and she is wearing quite the number. It is like a dusty sand-colored silk blouse with gold stirrup pants and cowboy boots.
Yes.
It is a monochromatic sort of Vegas sand.
Kind of Golden Girls-ish a little bit.
Yes.
Not really, but at least in terms of the drapey blouse.
Yep.
The color palette, if you will.
Yep. I can't imagine, to be honest, it looks very Palm Springs to me.
Yes.
not very Port Washington, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was definitely a look. We still got the crimped hair going on. Brendan says, "Do you have any idea what they're talking about?" And Carol says, "Not really. My junior high science fair project was 2 cups and a string." So, you know, once again, going back to the fact that, you know, times have changed and Mark is clearly head and shoulders above everyone. So then Frank comes in and says, "You know, I really want to have a night out with alone with you, because clearly they didn't get enough in Jamaica, which just happened, but they need a night out. They need to get away. He's got, you know, a reservation at Carmine's, which is apparently some kind of restaurant that's very hard to get a reservation in Port Washington.
And Frank is very, very horny for Carol, as always.
Very horny. Needs her alone. Yes. Must be gazing into her eyes, alone at a corner table, just romancing the shit out of her. Yes. He cannot wait.
No, and it's going to be a prelude to a wild night. You know, he's just, yes, always very horny for Carol.
Always. So, you know, he says, well, you know what would be fun? And she says, yeah, but the kids are still up. I mean, the two of them just can't get enough of each other. It's like eye-rollingly adorable. So Al and Dana enter as they're kissing once again. Dana is now wearing another bodysuit. It's blue. She has a strand of pearls on, a skirt with a belt over it. It's sort of like an A-line kind of mini skirt with a belt and then flats, of course. And the real topper on all of this is the massive white bow. The bow is so large.
It's floppy.
It's floppy.
It's kind of sheer. It's on the back of my head. This is a real, now we're starting to see Dana in the post overall period, getting into serving Chelsea Clinton realness.
Definitely.
A lot of times it's kind of dorky, kind of, I don't know.
Like United, like Model UN. It's very White House intern.
Yes, that's it. That is it.
West Wing light.
Ooh, it's a look. That bow. Wow.
Again, Port Washington, guys. Port Washington. It's a very elegant, classy look for a 16-year-old, 15-year-old. How old were you meant to be?
I think I was supposed to be about my actual age at the time. I think 16 by this time. And that was something the show seemed to struggle with is, you know, sometimes those notes would be bandied about, such as, listen, everybody, this is supposed to be a small town in Wisconsin. Why is everyone so glamorous? Like, right. Why is everyone's hair out to here? Why is that the outfit? What is up with this?
Yeah.
I mean, I remember those notes sometimes, but then I think ultimately the show was not Roseanne. It wasn't meant to be real life. It was meant to have that certain television patina on it. Yeah. You know, you have Suzanne Summers playing the mom. I mean,
she's going to wear a gold stirrup legging, guys. Like, just let it go. Just like buy into the illusion. We know we all want to see her in a gold stirrup legging. So just let it happen.
Let it just enjoy. Just and look, enjoy it. Did it take an hour and a half to do her hair like that? Yeah, absolutely. Would that have been in real life? Probably not. I know that she's a hairdresser, but she's also now a mom of six kids, three of her own, three stepkids who like are aggressively hating her at all times. But hey, listen, you know, she had her hair professionally done.
That's right. So she can, you know, supposedly do it in 5 minutes because all hairdressers can just, you know, do their own hair very quick. So they come in, they're kissing. Al has her Beavers uniform on. That's right. She's on a baseball team called, and their mascot is the Beavers.
Yeah. Why? Why was like, that the name of the team?
It couldn't have been the Tigers. It couldn't have been, you know, the Saints. Like the Beavers, I guess, because like a beaver is sort of a Midwestern
type of animal. You know what? There's
badgers even.
Yes, there are other types of animal that will serve you Midwest.
I feel like
you don't need to go with beaver.
It's such a sort of embarrassing sexual innuendo for a young tomboyish girl to be on a team called the Beavers.
Where, by the way, is she probably the only girl on the team?
Probably.
That was kind of the vibe. So I don't know. I don't know what's up with that.
I mean, the fact that I had to even wear that outfit that said the Beavers. I have friends who were like looking through photos, and I have pictures from this episode where I'm standing with Angie. Of course, they're the big like 5x7 photographs that I'm sure her mom took. And we are standing in my dressing room or hers. And she's wearing that outfit from this. This is probably on a tape night. And I have the Beavers. And I remember friends being like, what are you wearing? Why the Beavers? I'm like, I don't know. I didn't make it up. I didn't write it.
I'm starting to have, now that we're rewatching these episodes, which for me, it's going to be the first time seeing most of them, I'm beginning to have questions about Al's wardrobe. I can tell that you already
have a lot of questions.
But there are some of these looks, if you will, where I don't know what to think.
Baffling.
Stunning.
Yes.
But not stunning, like surprising.
Very. Yeah. Very. I agree.
And
I feel like I could go down a conspiracy theory hole with someone. Although it's probably not that deep. I think it's actually the opposite. I think it was like, just let her wear that. Doesn't matter.
She's a tomboy. She doesn't matter. She goes by Al. She plays sports.
She'll wear a scoop neck, you know, t-shirt, and then she'll wear like a button up that looks like it was out of her brother's closet. She's just putting on whatever's clean.
She doesn't care.
She doesn't care.
She is the foil to supermodel Karen.
Right.
And prissy bitch Dana.
Right.
Basically.
So Dana says something like, you know, ugh, don't you ever stop kissing? And then Al says, oh, you're not going to reproduce, are you? And he goes, not if you keep walking through the door. Oh, God, so many sexual jokes. Carol has said that she can't go to dinner because she's gotten on the committee for Al's backwards dance that's coming up. And, you know, Carol's really excited to do this because she wants to get to know Al better. Carol really, there's a lot of pipe that gets sort of fed here. There's a lot of episodes, I feel like, where Carol is consistently trying to cajole Al into liking her, becoming a family with her. Like, she thinks Al is going to be like the linchpin that's just going to like sweep the other two in. I don't know. It's interesting. So she thinks this is a way that we can like really get to know each other. But there's nothing really predicated on the fact, like, it doesn't seem like before that we had some big fight. She's just decided.
No, in fact, in the pilot, you have this big bonding moment
totally.
At the end of the episode. Yeah. And notice it's a backwards dance because the girls ask the boys. I don't think it would be called that now.
No. Nope.
I mean, Sadie Hawkins is that still a thing? I don't know. I feel like my high school had this, but it was called the Girls Ask the Boys Dance.
Right.
Clunky title, but says what it is and doesn't have any weird implications of, backwards. Well, the right way is the boy asked the girl. This is backwards.
Right. Totally. And she says, well, are you excited about the dance? You know, I'm on the committee. And Al sort of says, as she's putting her baseball bats into her, you know, large bag, she's like, great. Like, good luck with that. Like, have fun, knock yourself out. And she's like, well, aren't you going? And she's like, no, of course not. Like, Al is too good for this. She's not going to ask a boy to the dance. Like, give me a break. Doesn't care. So, you know, Carol is sort of like, oh, well, oh, okay. You know, I guess that's not what we're going to do. So then, you know, Carol decides, all right, she leaves. And then Frank decides to talk to Al a little bit about it. And he's like, you know, what about Roger? You know, Roger's on your team. Like, maybe you should give it a shot. You know, I guess what? Sometimes you just have to take a shot at it. Like, I went for Carol and I asked Carol and look what we got. And she sort of snarkily says to her dad, yeah, I got two jerky stepsisters and a brother who's trying to build a bomb in the basement. You know, and she sort of walks out like, that's not a great idea, Dad.
Yeah, like Al's denying that she's afraid of rejection. She's just playing it like she's too cool. And yeah, Frank wants her to get in there.
So now we get back. We're now into the next scene. We're into the kitchen and Dana is on the phone and she's trying to get tickets for something, but it's all sold out. And she's, you know, hangs up and says, oh, you know, this is what a mess or something like that. And Frank says, oh, is there a problem? She's like, yeah, Frank, that's usually what a mess means. She's so upset. And then she apologizes and said, I'm sorry for being rude. I told my music teacher I was going to get tickets to Cats and now they're all sold out and I don't know what I'm going to do. And Frank says, well, you know, you should ask JT because his best friend's dad is a ticket broker. And she's sort of horrified by the notion that she might have to ask JT for anything because they are arch nemesis at school. But she's sort of like, all right, begrudgingly says yes. And Frank is now feeling really good about himself. He's feeling he's got this parenting thing in the bag. He's basically just given Al some great advice about asking Roger. And now he's like hooking Dana up with the tickets. You know, he's two for two today. Dad and Al come back from the game and they've won and they do this weird beaver chant, which is just them being beavers.
And Frank is the coach.
Frank is the coach. Yep. Al is the pitcher and Roger is the catcher. We've seen a little bit from Mark and, of course, Urkel, who are very excited about, you know, planning their, they're continuing to work on their science fair project. And Al and Frank, you know, walk in. And of course, there's some ridiculous physical comedy with them trying to get out of the room and Urkel basically running into half the furniture and knocking it down as he was wont to do. And then he's, you know, Dad says, so I saw you talking out, you know, on the pitcher's mound with Roger. Like, you know, what were you saying out there? She's like, oh, I was just telling him, you know, don't just nothing crazy. Throw some fast ones. And then, yeah, I asked him to the dance. And he's like, oh, great. What'd he say? And Al sort of says, he said he was trying to throw fast ones. And he's like, no, about the dance. She's like, oh, he said yes. Yeah. Like, thanks, Dad. I really appreciate the advice. And, you know, this is just like really inflating Frank's ego. He's like, I've got this thing. There's a part of the scene after Frank tells Dana to go ask JT for the tickets where he's eating a cookie and Carol comes in with like overloaded with bags. She's got like 1,000 shopping bags.
And they're cloth grocery bags, I might add. This was very ahead of its time. This Agreed. Was cutting edge for this time in the 90s. You know, where are we now? What year was this? Did we
91?
Say?
91?
Where, yeah, cloth grocery bags were not a thing. And there were a few TV shows that were putting it out there and trying to make, like, normalize it.
Yeah.
And our show was one of them. So yeah. I had a little golf clap for our show.
I know.
Because Carol had her cloth bags anyway.
So Frank goes, oh, sorry, honey. And he goes to help her and he takes one bag out of like the 50 that she's carrying. And then he notices that there's animal crackers and he gets distracted and starts eating animal crackers. And she's doing all this, like this bit of physical comedy of trying to carry, juggle all the bags and has one in her mouth and the whole thing. And she's like, gee, thanks for the help, Frank. And he's like, yeah, no problem. Anytime, honey. But again, we're like going back to this, like, this, you know, trope of the dumb dad who doesn't recognize anything, doesn't grocery shop, doesn't know how to help with to carry in anything.
Yeah.
He's, you know, just wants to eat a cookie.
He's like a big kid.
Yeah. He's just like a big kid.
Oh, animal crackers. Hmm.
And they're also having a bit of a back and forth because he has now said, you know, she got off the committee so that they can go to dinner. And he's now said, no, actually, Al's going to the dance. So, but, you know, this will work out great. And she's like, oh, no, we can't go to the dance because I have to get back on that committee. And if she's going to go now, then I have to get back on it.
Right. Frank, so they can't go to their dinner.
So they can't go to their dinner. She went back on. And now, so the plans keep flip-flopping and Frank sort of has it. And he's like, you know, I am the man of the house. I wear the pants in this family. Don't I get to say what we do or not do on a Saturday night? And she says, shh, Frank, I'm on the phone. So she kind of throws it back at him. So now she has said yes to the dance. Time has passed and we are back in the kitchen and Grandma and Penny are making Al a dress. And Al is standing on a chair and they're hemming it. I can't tell if they've made it or if they're just hemming it. It looks like a church dress. It doesn't look like a party dress. It is like full puritanical, like church going dress.
This was unfortunate. I mean, it is floral. And then it has one of those big white collars on it that looks like somebody took a drop cloth and then cut it out into like a scallopy lacy shape and then dropped it over the front of the dress. So it's one of these collars. Like if you watched the season of The Crown where Diana, Princess Diana comes into it, she has several of these dresses where it's this huge white collar that just engulfs the entire front of the dress. But it's a little bit LDS. It's a little bit...
It's totally LDS.
And I'm thinking, if we're having this moment where the ladies of the family are dressing up Al in her first, dress for a dance, this is the dress? She looks like she is a secretary for PG&E or something.
It's awful.
In the 70s. Like, what is going on? But okay.
Grandma and Penny are fitting her for this dress. Penny is wearing this really sort of crazy red top and she's got a red flower in her hair and she's got this big pin on her lapel. She was always a bit extra and her hair is just ginormous. It's amazing. Al says something to the effect of like, well, I don't like, what should I even do on a date? And Grandma says, maybe you don't want to ask someone who dates people who are on parole. And
Penny, I loved this line. She Penny only says, don't take advice from someone who only dates men who are on parole. I love it.
And she says, he was not on parole. He escaped.
Which was funny, I thought.
It was really good. And then just at that moment, Carol comes in and she's with Frank as she's, you know, Al is getting this dress and she's like, oh, Al, you look so great. But then Urkel enters with Mark and he sees Al and he sort of does this very funny hubba hubba. And Al just kind of looks at him like, okay.
Like he took a time machine here from 1922.
Yeah. Al sort of like, oh, I mean, I think I should be flattered. What's happening? And then at that moment, Roger calls and she goes to answer the phone. And we quickly realize that Roger has dumped her. He has all but basically ghosted her. And she hangs up and she says, you know, he was just Roger. He's decided that he's going to ask a girl that he likes better. So it's fine. I guess I'm just not going to go to the dance. And she's kind of dejected, but Al's trying to sort of, you know, put on a brave face. And then she just tears the dress off. Like, yes. She's wearing a t-shirt and shorts under it.
Yeah, she's like a basketball player on the sidelines. Yep. And she has the Velcro warm-ups. And she just literally, you know, Incredible Hulks this dress off in one fell swoop.
It's such a strange, like, why couldn't she have just gone upstairs to change? Like, what? It was such a weird moment of, like, taking it off.
I think it was supposed to be the visual of, I'm not buying into this.
Yeah.
You people talked me into taking this risk. And now, I mean, Roger,
I'm going back to being a Tom girl.
Yes. Tomboy, yes. Because Roger is not just like, oh, I mean, apparently from when Al hangs up, he's not just like, oh, sorry, Al. It's, you know, something came up. He's a stone cold beast. I mean, he apparently just tells her straight up, a girl who I liked better asked me, so I'm going with her. I mean, yeah.
It's cold.
So it's this dramatic moment of.
Yeah. And this is what I love about the end of this act. There is the teary music. It is, we are hearing like violins, and Carol looks completely traumatized. Like Al leaves, and then there's a shot of Frank and Carol, and Frank looks concerned, and Carol looks like victimized and triggered by this entire exchange. It is so dramatic. And I was like, oh my God. She really felt for her. I was like, maybe my acting was just so amazing that I just really put her in this place. I mean, you could almost see tears. It was amazing.
Well, maybe that's it. Maybe Al is Carol's way in to these Lambert kids.
Yeah.
Which makes sense, right? Brendan's just a little kid. No problemo, basically. Yeah. He's just kind of happy-go-lucky from what we've seen of his character so far. And his character is little kid. Like, that's his character. He's correct. Just a sweet little kid. Done. And then JT is kind of a punky teenager, so he's going to be a tough nut. And then Al is also a tough nut to crack, but she's a little younger.
So she could be moldable.
Yes, and she's a girl. Right. So we can have mom, you know, she's probably missing a mother figure in her life.
Exactly.
And that will be me.
All right, we'll get into act two, but I think here we should take a little break. We'll be right back with more on the dance. Okay, and we're back. We are discussing episode two of Step by Step.
Season one,
the dance. So we're into act two. Frank and Carol are in the kitchen, and Frank says, guess what? This is great. I got Carmine. We're back on the books. I got reservations again. We're all good. And Carol is just like, Frank, well, you know, that's great and everything, but I actually couldn't get out of it. I got back on that committee. And when I called to say that I wanted to cancel, you know, they wouldn't let me out. Like, she really runs a hard bargain over there at the school. And she's like, by the way, why are you so upset about dinner? Well, A, because Frank is horny. We've already established that. Why are you so upset about dinner? Shouldn't you be worrying about Al? And he says, she's fine. Don't worry about her. I asked her, Al, how you feeling? And she said, fine. And Carol sarcastically says, well, gee, Frank, how'd you get her to open up like that? She says, now listen, you know, you got to talk to her. She's a 12-year-old girl. Ah, we're learning that she's 12. So she is not the 8-year-old munchkin land that we thought from the pilot. She is actually a 12-year-old girl. You know, you really need to go talk to her. And then Carol decides to tell a story about when she was dejected and how she asked, she goes, you know, boys can be really brutal. I asked so-and-so to the movies and he flat out rejected me and it was really hard. And she kind of is starting to work herself up, reliving the story. And she goes over and finds this pair of scissors that she's been cutting coupons with. And she just like stabs it into the butcher block and is basically like, grr, you know, all men are scum. And Frank is now really nervous. And he comes over to her and he's like, oh, honey, this sounds really hard. And it sounds like you were really upset by this. You know, when was this? And she says, right before I met you. And he's like, I'm going to back away slowly. And then he kind of like takes the scissors quickly when he leaves. He goes out to the backyard where Al is dejectedly oiling her catcher's glove and her baseball glove. And he sits down with her and he's, you know, doing the fatherly thing. He's like, Al, listen, you know, everyone goes through this. This is just a normal part of life. Carol went through it. I've been through it. And she's sort of, you know, starting to come around a little bit. And then all of a sudden, who should walk through from the kitchen but Karen, dressed to the nines in a silk blue patterned top and skirt combo with like sheer arms. Her hair is meticulous. It is French braided on one side.
On the side.
All the way back. And the other side is just loose. But it's like, it is once again like a perfect Pantene ad. And she's got her purse and she's probably ready to go to the mall. And Frank says, hey, Karen, you know, let me ask you a question. Has a guy ever broken a date with you? And she's like, no, never. And he's like, really? Not even once? Why, no. I mean, I think if someone did that to me, I'd die. So she is of no help. Al dejectedly gets up to leave. I look like I'm wearing boxer shorts. I don't know what's happening. I'm wearing a yellow t-shirt and some kind of striped shorts that do not lay flat. They're like bunchy. So when you stand up, they're just like a balloon short. Yeah. They're not attractive. They maybe give, like, I had such a bubble butt in these shorts. I don't know what's going on.
I don't know.
I was wearing like bed shorts. They were boxer bed shorts.
I don't know what is happening.
It was like Ragamuffin Central. Anyway, so I go inside. Gee, thanks a lot, Dad. And then he looks at Karen. He's like, thanks, Karen. And she's like, yeah, anytime I can help. You know, just totally clueless about it all.
Yeah, because Karen is so stunning and flawless that no guy would ever reject her. It's ludicrous.
They're lining up for dates with Karen.
Yeah.
Now we're back into the family room and Dana is pacing. She's nervous. She's waiting for these tickets. And she is pacing in a scoop neck dress.
Scoop neck. I hate a scoop neck to this day. I hate it. It is just so unflattering. And I know, look, I get it. Okay. I know some of you out there love a scoop neck. It does not work for me. And I remember my mom making comments such as,
tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You look better in tailored things.
Tailored things.
Tailored things. I think what tailored means, in case you're wondering, is not a scoop neck.
Yeah, no. It's more of like a collared, a V.
Something with a structure, a shape. But this big, scoopy.
No. And my favorite part of it, which you really had to look closely, the back. This was one of those dresses in the 90s.
Yes! I made a note of this!
That had the scrunchy band with the two clips. And you would take the sides of your dress in the back and you would clip them together and the scrunchie band would kind of like bring them together and it would give you a little shape.
Yes, it would cinch it. You could cinch it. You could cinch it. And you could buy these things for you kids out there who don't know what the hell we're talking about. That was a pretty perfect description. It's a scrunchie with two clips on it, but you could buy them the scrunchie fabric. You know, you could get all different ones.
Right.
So you could go to Contempo.
Right.
For example, and buy the cash register or whatever, you could buy a set of, say, three of these items, and one would be black, one would be red, and one would be a pattern, let's say. So they would coordinate with your different outfits. And then, yeah, you could scrunch it, not to make it tight, but just to
like give it a little shape.
Yes, to take your flowered rayon sack of a dress and then just give it the slightest little dip in at the waist.
They were very popular.
Oh, man.
This is a trend that we will see for a couple of years, I feel like, on that show.
Oh, my God, yes.
Because I think I remember the costume assistants wearing them. So I think everybody, you know, it's like when somebody gets into a mode of something they like and then they just want everyone to wear it. I feel like this was probably one of those times.
It was popular, though. Yeah.
Very popular. Mm. So she is wearing this scoop neck, cinch waist. She has a half braid. So it's like a half braid with like a ponytail. So half of it's a French braid and then it goes into ponytail and there's another bow. It's a different colored one. This is a dark bow, but it's another big kind of floppy bow and another strand of pearls.
The pearl. Yeah. I think between the pearls, the bow, I think the point is, listen, you need to get audience that Dana is a prissy uptight bitch. Okay,
right.
That is what the pearls, the bow, and I might add this brownish brick-colored lip.
Oh, yes.
Again.
We have a baked bean lip.
Yes. So, yeah, prissy uptight bitch. In case you're wondering, that's who this character is. I would not wear that lip today because I would consider it to be too harsh.
Right.
And I was 16 in this lip.
It was a little intense.
Unbelievable.
But again, it was the 90s. We were seeing a lot of pale faces, dark eyebrows.
Brown lips.
Brown lips.
And there are some women who you know when they were teenagers and when they kind of first discovered their look.
Yeah.
Because they're still in a brown lip.
Oh, yeah.
Still.
For sure. We were rocking Spice Pencil for
years.
At least 5 years on that show.
Oh, yeah.
The Spice was all over it. I mean.
Yes.
The Black Honey, the Spice, we had it all.
Oh, yeah.
So she is pacing around. JT comes through with the tickets. I've got your tickets. And she is so excited. And she goes to grab him out of his hand. And he's like, what do you got for me? And she's like, fine. Here's Cindy's phone number, but don't tell her where you got this. So that's their exchange. He wants a girl's phone number, but he got her the tickets to Cats. And she's so excited to take her music teacher to Cats. And then she opens up the tickets and she's like, the Wisconsin Cats show. What is this, a joke? Is this some of your Lambert hillbilly humor? And he's like, what are you talking about? You said you wanted to go to Cats. I got you the tickets. She's like, I asked you to get me tickets to Cats, the musical. And he's like, a musical where cats sing? Well, that's got flop written all over it. And Dana is pissed, like so pissed. And she starts like hunting him down and she's like moving him backwards and he's getting nervous. And she's like, I'm going to give you a 30-second head start and then I'm going to hunt you down like a dog. And he's like, huh? And so he runs and she just continues this very slow saunter.
Psychotic.
It was such a good, I love that moment in the show. I remember that specifically because it was like such good physical comedy. You kind of did this thing where you're like, I'm going to hunt you down like a dog. And you're like, the way you were just like walking towards the door, you kind of, you're like chin jutted out and you're just sort of like, like if you had a cigarette, you would have taken a big puff of it and like thrown it on the ground as you like went through the swinging door. Like it was so choice. It was so good. Then we have Carol and Frank coming down the front stairs and they are dressed to go chaperone for the dance.
And just a side note here, folks, on all of these shows, there was a front stairs and a back stairs.
That's
so
right.
So when Christine says front stairs, that term is used advisedly because something about these producers, their whole aesthetic, or perhaps what was convenient for getting characters in and out of a room in different ways, there was always a front staircase and always a back staircase. Now, I don't know how many houses have that in real life. I don't know if this was a big feature in the Midwest where one of the, you know, main producers was from. I mean, he was from Port Washington. I'm from Pennsylvania. We in fact, did have a house with a front and a back staircase. It's a thing, but there is always that in these shows.
Yeah. Actually, our house in Atlanta, where I grew up, when you walked in, there was a foyer, and that was the front staircase. And then you would go into the house, and by the living room, like the family room in the back, we had a back staircase there. But I always really loved the idea that there was a staircase in the kitchen. It seems like random, but it also sort of feels like very accessible. Like when you're thinking about like how you all like come down and eat and, you know.
Yeah.
I sort of always loved what that house in real life would have been. Really, you would just go up the stairs and the stairs would just end. And you would have to wait in these like little, you know, you would wait on top of the stairs. And there was a red light, and the AD downstairs would
the assistant director
would, when it was your turn, because sometimes you couldn't really hear what was going on, or they needed to cue you a little bit early so that you would make it down by your line so that we kind of figure out the timing during rehearsal. And then they would like put the light on, and half the time we weren't paying attention
or we were eating, chatting, whispering.
Such a nightmare. I mean, we were nightmares. And when we would be doing these like run throughs, I remember Charlie, he would get so
Was the AD
uptight because he'd be like, I'm pressing the button. I'm pressing the button.
And we would cue the red light.
And we would be like, la-di-da-di-da-di-da.
Standing on this landing, which we called the staircase to nowhere because it was a staircase to nowhere.
And then we would start writing notes. And then there would be like drawings. And I mean, it just became like, I think Stacey would leave glasses of like old juice up there. Old crusty juice. It was just, we were.
You know, it's fun working with kids.
It is. We had a lot of fun. okay. So Carol and Frank come down the stairs. Carol is wearing, I don't know how to describe this.
Oh, this was a doozy.
Yeah. She's wearing a dress that is tight. It's sort of like a bandeau type dress, but from the, I would say the empire waist down to about her knees, it's black. She's wearing black hose and a black shoe.
A sheer stocking, yes.
Sheer stocking. But on the top part, like where it starts at the bust and to the sleeves,
yeah, like the bodice.
It is black polka dot chiffon.
Yeah, like black background with white polka dots.
It's like a polka dotted chiffon, kind of a puffy sleeve. Like it feels really specific.
It's very
90s.
It's a little bit mega church.
Yeah.
A little bit like the pastor's wife maybe wore this.
Totally. It kind of reminds me of the dress that Julia Roberts wears in Pretty Woman when she goes shopping, like after she like has the bad experience and they like kick her out. And then she like goes back in and she's like, I'm going to show you because now I got all Richard Gere's money. And she's like wearing this like puffy kind of polka dotted chiffon like thing with a hat.
Oh, and then the polka dots, when they go to that polo game or whatever, it's very interesting. It's like a cream dress with a brown polka dot.
Right.
So polka dots were having a moment and they were big. I mean, the polka dots, by the way, on Carol's dress are not petite. They are the quarter sized or silver dollar sized.
Yes. And she's also wearing a matching polka dot scrunchie. She's got her hair pulled back into a low pony.
I wanted to love this look, but I could not get there.
It's tough.
Now look. Suzanne has an incredible figure. Suzanne Summers, of course, who played Carol. You cannot go wrong with putting her in a tight dress.
She looks great.
She looks great. It's just the dress.
The dress is just an odd choice. It's an odd choice, I feel like, for this character.
It was a little disappointing because I'm kind of like, you have Suzanne Summers. Live it up.
I know.
You know?
I also think we chalk this look up a little bit to the times we were in.
True. You know? True. And she does have to, you know, she's going there in a mom capacity
to
be a chaperone. So she can't be sexing it up.
We're not going to
Carmine. I get it.
Right.
Yeah. Fine.
And Frank is wearing some kind of pleated tan pant with sort of a marbled, I don't know what you call this. It looks like a watercolor painting. Like the shirt looks like a watercolor.
Difficult to capture in words. But the pants, we see him several times in these pants. And man, a pleated front pant is rough. I don't know who that is flattering on. Only because he's Patrick Duffy and he's an international, you know, beefcake and heartthrob, you know, legend. Can he rock these pants? But I have a friend who still calls these pants out. Pants. They are still worn today. Any type of khaki she just refers to as an ass pant. And I get it. Sorry. Yeah.
It's like every ass in every 80s movie wore a pleated khaki pant. So anyway, they come down And Steve and Mark burst into the house and they've won first prize at the science fair.
Yeah, of course, because they like discovered a new element or something. So yeah.
Exactly. And they're so excited. Something about nuclear fission. Yeah, of course they're doing that. So Mark's like, I can't wait. I'm going to go put my trophy up next to my working model of the human intestine, which is a disgusting thing to think about.
Scary.
And Frank and Carol hurry off to the dance. So Urkel is left there and Al comes in dejected with two bags of chips and a soda. About to eat her feelings because it's the night of the dance. She's clearly home. She's still wearing boxer shorts.
For some reason,
she sits down. Hi, Steve. And Steve says, oh, hey, I heard about what happened. So I guess the rumor mill has been flying around the house that Al got
about
rejected.
What a jerk Roger is.
And everybody's been talking about it. It's the latest gossip. And he's like, you know what? Don't get it. Don't let it bother you. And Al gets annoyed. And she's like, you know, I'm really sick of getting advice from people about being dumped from people who have never been dumped. And he does this like take that is so funny. He had some of the most incredible comedic timing, Jaleel White. He really had some amazing timing. He just kind of looks out like, and the audience is going crazy because as we all know, Urkel is not very savvy in the romantic department.
Now, when you did this episode, were you already a fan of Jaleel? Did you know who he was?
Oh, yes, I did. Because I knew who everybody on TGIF was. I watched all the shows. So I was a huge fan and I was a bit intimidated because he was a big star. Like this was not the first season of Urkel. Like he had already been on that show a couple of times and like, he was kind of the breakout character.
He was the breakout character. He was the star. Yeah. So were you?
He had a catchphrase. He like, you know, so yeah, there was a little part of me that was kind of, you know, I was a little bit intimidated. I don't know. He was very savvy. He knew his character. He knew he had worked with Rich before. He like knew that he was going to, you know, he was going to knock that table over that he was going to. And it was like
that's Rich Carell, the director.
Yeah, Rich Carell.
And apparently, so the story goes, Rich Carell and Jaleel created this character together.
Oh, yeah. I think that's right. And so I think, how do I say, he's very comfortable in his craft.
Right.
And for someone who was just doing like what I think we actually filmed this as the fifth or sixth episode, but it came out as maybe the second. And for someone who was only like five episodes in on the only TV series I'd ever been on, I was just sort of in awe a little bit.
Yeah, he was a TV star.
Yeah.
And watching him, I thought, wow, for a kid that age, you know, he was probably a young teenager at that point, maybe 13 or 14,
yeah,
maybe at the most.
I would say 14, 15.
Okay. It's hard to look bad on TV. And not that he looked bad. I mean, he looked adorable. But, you know, he was playing this super dorky guy, super dorky character.
And
so
the
they
voice,
have him in these
and the whole thing. Yep.
Skin-tight jeans with the waist hiked up and all the clothes are so tight. And he has this, you know, kind of hunched over stance that he does where his knees are bent, you know, and his elbows
his pelvis is tucked
under.
Yeah,
and his elbows are sticking out and he's got these enormous glasses. You know, to be that age and to be okay with looking that dorky on TV, you got to be brave. I mean, I never wanted to look bad.
Right.
I wanted to look pretty and cute. You know, I was too self-conscious to, like, if I had to play that kind of character where, you know, I looked that goofy, I would have felt bad about it. And I would not want, you know, my friends at school making fun of me, which they did anyway, by the way.
Right.
And I wasn't even playing an Urkel type of character.
Right.
But yeah, so good on him.
I know. And you know, the thing that I thought was very interesting was that, and I guess I don't know why it surprised me because I didn't imagine he was like that in real life. But you know, as someone who was a bit of a novice, walking into this kind of experience with someone that I had watched on television, it was really interesting to me that he would pop in and pop out. Like,
yeah, because he was very cool.
Very
in real
cool.
Life. Very cool.
Very cool.
Not like Urkel at all. In fact, he was more like the
Stefan.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was Stefan is more the real Jaleel.
Yeah.
Then, yeah.
Who then became his like alter ego cousin. I don't know if he was a cousin
something, who's super smooth and super suave and loves the ladies and the ladies love him. And,
totally.
Yeah.
But he was really, I remember he was really into, you know, the cameras. He wanted to, you know, get on the other side of cameras. He was interested in directing and how, you know, how it all worked. And I have pictures of the two of us because the camera crew, They were so incredible. They became like family to us too. They were really open to allowing us to sit on the cameras, to learn how the cameras worked. They would let us touch them. They would let us move them around. They would let us pull focus. We basically played with these very expensive pieces of equipment. And back then, like, we were filming on film. We had actual rolls of film on top of the camera that they would have to change out.
Yes, they would have these huge magazines, is what they were called. Now, these cameras are the size of like half a golf cart.
Yes.
I mean, when Christine says they would let us get on the cameras, if you're wondering what the hell she is talking about, it's because it took, I think, 3 people to operate each camera, because it was this massive thing on wheels. So there would be one person in the back pushing this massive rolling camera unit thing to the next mark. So during the rehearsals with the cameras, because a few days we didn't rehearse with the cameras, and then there were 2 days where we would rehearse with them, they would put down marks. So somebody was in charge of driving the camera around and parking it on its next mark and knowing what the next mark was, and the next one and the next one, right? Mm-hmm. And then there was the actual camera operator sitting on the camera, sitting on this massive thing and, you know, sitting actually behind it, looking through it and operating it. And then you had a focus puller on the side. So we had 3 cameras, right? Yep. Yeah, 3. So that's how many people
and like all doing this kind of symphony choreography of moving around, getting different, you know, angles.
Making sure there's some people had to make sure the cords didn't get tangled up. So somebody was back there managing that. There's all the marks. There's, not hitting each other, not getting in anybody's shot. Just a lot.
We were one of the last shows to be filmed on actual film.
Really?
Yeah. Because they started to use video, like Full House is actually a video show.
Oh, yeah. And it's a different look. It's that brighter, poppier,
yes,
more saturated. The film has a kind of more, I think, a
it
little
has
bit
a more dimension to it.
Yeah, and it's darker. It has a darker look, but I think it's a little more elegant. But yeah, they would have these film magazines, this massive thing that kind of looks like you might picture it. It's like a plastic case over 2
like old school
huge rolls of film, and they would have to pop that thing off and replace it with a new magazine.
And then they would run that footage through an Avid. I mean, it was and they would literally like cut it and split, like, it's like, so it's crazy how different things are. Wow. Even focus now, people can focus without running a tape. They can do it all like digitally from the camera.
That's what the focus puller did. They would run an actual
measuring tape
from the lens to whatever was supposed to be the point of focus. And then they would have to adjust the focus based on that measurement. I mean, or real. I mean, to think that now your iPhone takes these incredibly high quality photos and no one has to get out a measuring tape.
It's crazy. And then, we would have to like hit our marks. We would have to stand on, our marks, and we'd have to like be pretty precise, because if you overshot your mark, you would be either screwing up a camera angle or the focus would be off. So
yes, or the light. You would not be in the light at how the light was designed for you to be in it. You might be in shadow if you didn't hit the mark. Patrick was famous for that. He would just kind of lift you up like Hercules and just without anyone seeing it, I don't know how he did this, and just sort of like place you on your mark like you were a Lego person.
Yep. He would kind of nudge you over. He would pull you back. He would if you were not on your mark, you would just had a way of in the scene. He just subtly did it. His brain worked like that. He could be completely in the scene doing comedy and also realizing that 3 people weren't on their mark, and he could sort of like.
And we're working with kids. We're going to be here all night long.
If I don't
so
do
let's
this.
Get this done.
It was amazing. It was really amazing. So he says, "Are you kidding me? Like, I've been dumped more than anyone." And she's like, "Really? Well, God, even if I wanted to go to the dance, it's too late. Like, who could I even ask?" And then Urkel does this incredible sort of like, where he's basically hawking up loogies for 5 minutes, like, "Notice me, notice me." And she says, "Wait, you?" And he's like, "Well, I don't know. Let me check my schedule." And he pulls out this little black book and he's like, 9 o'clock free, 10 o'clock free, 8 o'clock free. Perfect. I'm in. And she's like, "Okay, great. I'll go change." And then he has a little moment where he's like, "Ugh, you got a girl in Chicago, girl in Milwaukee. You are one bad dude. You know, he's just really feeling himself at that moment. And then he trips over the table.
And the table explodes.
And the table explodes.
like a bomb fell on it.
It's great. So now we're at the end of the episode. The dance is in the gymnasium. Carol and Frank are there. There's a bunch of kids running around in various party attire. Lots of sneakers and Running Man. Lots of primary colors again. All the kids are doing the Running Man and the Roger Rabbit. And we have Carol and Frank. They're over by the punch bowl. And for some reason, I don't remember, there must have been some dialogue in the beginning of this scene that got cut. And we just went straight to Al and Urkel entering because they have the weirdest looks on their faces. They look so concerned, like as if they just said something.
Oh.
But they're both just kind of like, they're not just like pleasantly looking at the kids. They both look really troubled, which is really funny to me for some reason. Anyway, we walk in and they're like, Al, you came. And I guess we just have to assume that they live close enough to
hitchhiked. Hitchhiked. Urkel and Al hitchhiked. They got in the back of a white van. We don't know what happened.
They got there.
They're
somehow
here and they're fine.
And by the way, no one is babysitting the other kids at home. Clearly, maybe Penny and Grandma are. Who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows? Once again, the kids are feral and up to their own devices. Yes. So she says, "Yeah, you know, you gave me some really good advice, and you know." And Urkel decided to come with me. And they're like, that's great, Al. I'm so proud of you. Al is wearing
the dress. Yes. I love this dress.
I actually really like this dress, too.
I love it. I was so happy for you.
Finally.
Finally. And it was so much better than the like Saints sister version. Wife,
yeah.
Cult, whatever that other thing was you were supposed to wear.
Easter 91, some kind of, fourth grade Easter dress.
This was adorable.
It was flowered. It has what I think you call that a sweetheart neck. It's like a square with a sweetheart. It had a little cap sleeve. It had a drop waist, which actually looked really cute. And then it had this kind of flary sort of skirt to it.
It had a, what do you call
it? It almost had like crinoline underneath.
Yes, yes. It looked like, you know, Betsy Johnson dresses at that time would straight up come with an actual tulle crinoline underneath. Now, this dress does not quite have the mark of Betsy Johnson on it, but it definitely had that tulle crinoline underneath. So cute because it just sticks out. It makes this great kind of A-line. It was so adorable. And
it was
then
really cute.
Your hair looked great.
They finally did my hair.
Finally
it wasn't
did your
just
hair.
Just in a ponytail with floppy bangs.
And then you had long, thin ribbons.
Yeah, they were ribbons.
Coming down. It was so cute.
Was
I loved
really,
it.
I loved that
you
dress.
Looked adorable.
I felt really special in that dress. And then I'm wearing like a little black flat, you know, which is probably age appropriate. Urkel is a little bit dressed up. He's got on his little sport coat that he's had on since the science fair. And so he's like, "You want to dance?" And I'm like, "Let's do it." So we start walking towards the dance floor, and who should show up but Roger.
I hate that guy.
He's got some real like blonde kind of wavy poofy hair, and he's like, "Al, whoa, you know, wow, you look great." And
she's because he's only ever seen her in her Beavers uniform.
Mm-hmm. Carol does say something like, "Oh, Al, I almost didn't, you look so great, I almost didn't recognize you." And
Shady
Al sort of gives her this look like, huh? And she's like, "Oh," and then she gets all flustered. She's like, "I've just never seen you in a dress. It's a good look on you." Like, you know, she's like foot and mouth, insert foot and mouth. Anyway, so then Roger's like, you know, "Hey, my date's off getting some punch. You want to dance? And she's like,
and Roger's like the hot dude of the whatever grade that is, seventh grade or something.
Seventh
grade. Yeah, his hair is good. He's tall. He's cute. He's clearly very confident. And he's a
total. So then Al says, "Oh, Roger, you're asking me to dance? Well, I can only say one thing. Take a hike, Moonface."
You know, ha!
And the audience is like, "Woohoo!" and so then Urkel says, "All right, you know, let's dance." And he gives the DJ some like really complicated instructions. And then he's like, "Just play a fast one." And then the strangest thing happens.
You're not going to believe this, everybody.
Out of nowhere, there is no precursor to this.
Nope.
There is no pipeline laid for this.
Mm-mm.
There's just a beat that happens. All the kids suddenly just kind of like get up, like what's going to happen? And Steve Urkel goes into a rap. He starts rapping about the Urkel dance.
Yes. And by the way, the thing that he told the DJ to play, like play a fast one. Well, the DJ doesn't just play a fast one. He plays
He plays an Urkel song.
He plays a song he somehow that clearly Urkel already knew.
It's like, do it. Do it.
Do it. Everybody. Everybody. Do the Urkel dance. Like, that's the background singers.
Right. So there's like six ladies on this track that are singing harmonized. Do it. Do it. Ba-da-ba-da. Everybody.
Do the Urkel dance.
And the kids, instead of looking massively confused and kind of looking around as if to be like, wait, what? Everyone's just like, oh, okay. Yeah, let's do it. Let's do the Urkel dance.
And then he starts doing it. So he does this little rap and then he just gets into the dance number. And the kids behind us, I remember they were cast at, cause they were dancers. So they were like cast as, you know, extras, but they had dance ability. And so, you know, we practiced this dance and
choreo
already over the
foreshadowing.
Exactly. But they wanted it to look like they didn't know it. So I remember them telling them, okay, kids in the back, watch the first time and just like kind of pretend like you're learning it. But Christine, you sort of pretend like you don't know it either, like you're not real good at it, but you should do the moves. I'm like, so I'm doing all the moves, but I'm pretending like I don't know what the moves are.
You know, you played it really well, I thought. It's tough because this is reality bent at a very hard angle here. Yeah. But you made it work because it's like you're just being a good sport and you're like, yeah, I want to do the Urkel dance, but I don't know what it is. So you're watching him and you're just following what he's doing. I thought it worked.
Yeah, I mean, we faked it, you know, and it just becomes this flash mob. And then all of a sudden, all the kids are doing the dance and all the kids know the dance. And we're like bending over and like going back on one hand and like hitching up our pants and doing this weird kind of like, I don't know what you call that. We did something in a circle where we like go around with one leg and we're kind of jigging. And then of course, Patrick and Suzanne he's like, well, if we couldn't get alone, like we couldn't get away together, but right now this is really great. It feels like we're alone. And Carol's like, what are you talking about, Frank? We're standing in the midst of all of these children. He's like, yeah, but no one's looking at us. So then they start cheek to cheek slow dancing. They're probably making out in the corner.
Yes. To the Urkel dance.
To the
song.
Urkel dance.
And those extras, by the way, are the background dancers. They were dancing their is off. Oh,
they were like pro. They were professional. I could not believe children dancers.
The level of enthusiasm was level 100.
Yes.
Like they're smiling, they're into it, they're fully working it. And some of these girls, I mean, for girls that were supposed to be about 12 or 13, again, they are dressed like Carol from HR. Some of these outfits, it's like a long black rayon blazer that's buttoned up all the way with like a V-neck. And then there's like a flowery skirt under it where I'm like, I think Trish from HR wore that to a meeting last week.
Also a girl wearing a purple double-breasted suit jacket with long purple shorts.
I noticed that one too.
That one is real choice.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
There were some Lukes.
That was definitely a Luke. And then the show just ends. That's
it. Okay, bye.
It's like, Urkel dance, pose, and goodbye. And then it just ends. And that's it. Big grand finale, everyone. So that is episode 2 of The Dance.
Now, question before we go.
Yeah.
What is the worst hair of this episode?
Oof.
I'll start if you need to think.
Oh, definitely. I think I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to go with that bow look. That first bow look, I think on you. And I'm only saying that because of the bow. The braid was actually great, but the bow is not necessary.
Unanimous on that one. That was absolutely my pick that I wrote down. Dana's half up, half down with huge white floppy bow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Al's hair for, I would say, the first 3/4 of the episode is not great. Like, the bangs are almost flipping out.
It's just neutral.
It's neutral just kid hair.
Tomboy Al. And then she's transformed into a princess for the dance with the fabulous hair. Now, what about the outfit that you would wear today?
Ooh, God, this episode, yikes. It's pretty tough. Huh.
While you're thinking, I'm going to give you my answer, which I wrote down, which is none. None. Not the scrunchie with the clips on the back of the dress. None of it.
I don't think I could go with any. If I had to, like, if it was the choice of going naked or having to wear one of those outfits, I would probably say, I guess I'd go with the sun tanned, like long blouse with the boots and the golden stirrup pants. I mean, that at least is like monochromatic. And I think I could like get away with it for like a second.
Work it. Yeah. I mean, I thought of that too. If I had to pick one, I would go with Carol's pastor's wife bandage dress with polka dotted bodice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't love it, but if I had to, at least you have the bandage dress on the part, on the bottom part, flattering, shows the figure, et cetera. Right. And you just, I mean, what are you going to do about those polka dots?
People just think you're going retro. They just think you're making a retro 90s statement. Well, I mean, I thought this was a, how did you feel like this, aside from the fashions, how did you feel like this episode kind of stacked up? How do you feel like it held up?
You know, I almost think the worst thing about it is the best thing about it. The complete unreality of that Urkel dance song and the Urkel choreo and then all the kids jumping in and doing the choreo is so bad that it's just kind of sweet and good.
Yeah.
No show would ever do this today. It is so goofy and so silly and just so unreal, but you know, but it's fun. I mean, he was Urkel and listen, we got a group dance number.
For sure. I mean, I love a group dance number. It makes me so happy.
Yeah. So what do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. It kind of feels like there's a lot of tropes going on for sure. but it's sort of like all is forgiven because we all love a musical number.
Yeah.
And it's so funny. A lot of people, I think who have watched the show recently, I'll get a lot of questions about the Urkel dance. Like if I remember it, if I can do it, if I know the lyrics, I'm kind of like, I don't think I do. But then I watched it and I was like, oh, it all came back to me. I knew exactly when I was watching it, I knew what the next move was.
Well, and I don't know if everyone knows this, but Christine went on to work as a choreographer.
Yeah.
At times. And yes.
Because I was a dancer. I was never really... Al was the one who was very, you know, athletic, but I was actually really bad at sports. I was, again, the size of an 8-year-old. So even kickball was a struggle.
Me
so
<too.
laughs> my sport was dance. So that's what I did. And you know, I was always really happy. I think the producers knew that. And I was like, oh, excited to actually do something that had dance in it.
Yeah, that's what I meant before when I said foreshadowing, not foreshadowing in the show, but foreshadowing that later, Lakeskins here ended up being a choreographer.
Yes, for many years. I took all of that, my parents' hard-earned money that they put into my dance lessons. And I was like, well, I'm going to make another career for myself. And I just started teaching actors how not to be afraid of movement. And I would go to sets like True Blood and 90210 and... various films, and then the Goldbergs. And I would teach all these people different random things from flash dance to dirty dancing to line dancing, whatever the script called for. I would get in there and be like, okay, Anna Paquin, you and I are going to do some choreography today about, and we're going to be like fairies. And we did all this kind of like yoga-esque sort of, you know, stuff I made up. And we worked on that for this is like the other career I had for many years. Yeah.
That is so cool. And that's such a good way to put it. I remember when we would have, because this show ended up having a number of song and dance, you know, sequences.
It did.
And that's exactly what those choreographers had to do. They had to show up and teach non-dancers how to do what they needed to do and how to not be afraid. And there isn't much time and they have to get them up and running and doing these moves fast. And it's such a, you're not choreographing dancers who know what they're doing or know how to move or have turnout or have anything.
Totally.
And you have to get them not scared. So you have to devise moves that aren't too difficult that they're actually going to be able to do, but yet that meet the assignment in terms of what the dance is supposed to be. It seems really hard to do.
Yeah, you have to quickly, you have to kind of, what I always did in my mind, I would do the best case scenario and then I would kind of get into a rehearsal and then I would quickly assess like how quickly it was being picked up or what, like you can quickly assess whether someone has rhythm or whether they know how to move their body.
Yes.
A lot of people don't have any awareness. They could be very sexy individuals, but they have no actual awareness of their body and how it moves and how they move or what they look like when they move or they're like walking with their right and their left arm. They're not swinging their arms. And like all of a sudden people become like robots and they don't know how to move. And you're like, ah. So you have to kind of quickly assess and be like, all right, let's take this down to the like most brass tacks level we can. Let's start really small and let's see where we can build from there. And as long as it's like simple and concise and clean, that always looks better than trying to have somebody through something really complicated. So that's kind of where I would just build up the confidence a lot.
Yeah. Right. You have to be a cheerleader for people. I even remember that of those choreographers. Like, you know, yeah, it looks great. You've got it. They have to, because they're like, you got to do this on camera tomorrow.
Right.
And there's a live audience too. So get your
together. And if you don't feel good in your mind, it will show all over your face and certainly in your body. And you'll make a mistake and your face will cringe and like you'll stop the take and you'll get in your head. And
oh my God. So it's kind of like the opposite of So You Think You Can Dance, where you can be this choreographer where you can just envision your dreams.
Right.
And then you have these mega trained dancers who will just be your perfect instrument and just personify this dance to the highest level. I mean, in a way, that's almost easy because you can just have what you want and they better know how to do it. They probably are going to know how to do it.
Oh, yeah.
But then this is the opposite. You've got like trash can dancers that you're trying to
pretty much
kind of rustle up into something from nothing.
And sometimes you get really surprised, you know, as people will come in and say, I'm not a dancer. I don't like this and I don't feel comfortable doing this. And they'll give you like a lot of pushback right from the beginning, right when they meet you. And I always do this sort of like, oh yeah, no, I get it. Yeah. I said, well, listen, you know, we're just going to try some stuff. We're just going to play whatever doesn't feel good to you. Look, I'm here to help you. So whatever doesn't feel good to you, you know, and I put it on them as if it's all their ideas and then kind of make them feel comfortable and then build up the confidence and be like, oh my God, you're amazing. And then, you know, after an hour or whatever, we're doing what I actually wanted them to do in the first place.
Oh.
So it's a little bit of reverse psychiatry.
Yeah.
But it's funny because, you know, for years I had this choreography agent after I just sort of fell into this other career. And he would say, so, you know, the Emmys are coming up, wondering if there's anything you want to submit. And I'd be like, Steve, I really appreciate your belief in me. While I believe that what we did in Flashdance on the Goldbergs was excellent, I don't know that if in that category, which at the time was So You Think You Can Dance, that was included in the same category, because there's only one category for choreography.
Oh, God.
It was So You Think You Can Dance, Dancing with the Stars. I was like, yeah. I really appreciate it, but I don't think at this time.
Oh.
But like, why is it in the same category? That makes no sense.
No, because it's such a different, you're having to kind of do magic as opposed to being able to.
Shouldn't there be like a competition variety show and then also just like comedy, scripted comedy?
Yeah, or taking actors who have never danced and making them, you know, able to pull off this sequence that the writers have put together, which is such a different craft and skill.
It's a totally different beast. Yeah. But prepared me well, I think, as a director, because it's really so much of it is about the personal relationship with the performer.
Ah,
because. And then also appeasing what the writer or the director is actually, or the producer is asking of you in your other ear. And
yes.
They don't look good. And I'm like, thank you. I know. I'm working on it.
Because Lakin is also a director.
Yeah.
These days, everybody.
But so. I've, you know, and still strange because I actually always wanted to, since we've done so many episodes of multicam, I've still never been able to crack that multicam space.
Oh.
And it's the thing that I actually feel like I know better than anything.
Sure.
But it's like one of the hardest, it's one of the hardest nuts to crack to get in because nobody can tell you as a director, like if you go do a short film or even like a, you know, an independent movie or a sizzle, people can basically tell if you know how to direct or not. You know how to get coverage, you know how to put it together, you know how to, even as a choreographer, they lended me, you know, some ins in that department. But you can't really go fund your, I really want to be a multicam director, so I'm just going to put together like a quick short of multicam. Like, no one's doing that. No one's like GoFunding their dream project.
So there are still multi-camera shows?
There are, yeah. Not many, but yeah, there are. They're mostly Chuck Lorre shows.
Oh,
like there's mostly like CBS shows, but there are still a few. There's a lot of kids shows that are still multicam.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, or hybrid. Now I think a lot of them have gone hybrid. But yeah,
wow.
They're nice because, you know, Fast and Funny. I like Fast and Funny and Home by 6:30.
Yes, Fast, Funny, Home by 6:30. You shoot that show in one evening.
Oh, man. It's the greatest schedule, wasn't it?
Oh, yes.
It was so good. We'd be home by like 9 o'clock on a Friday night. 9:30, maybe. We'd be start at 6 and would take like 3.5 hours to shoot the show. And
yes,
we'd all go home. It was amazing.
Yes, there's two different schedules. If your producers are religious and if they're Jewish, then your shoot night is not on Friday night because they need to be home by sunset on Friday night.
I didn't think about that.
So yes, so those shows, which I was on a show like that previously, your shoot night would be a Tuesday night. So it was a little bit of a staggered thing. And then you would start your new episode on Wednesday.
Right.
For that reason, if you don't have religious producers like that, then you would shoot on a Friday night, which this show was a Friday night show.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah,
the two different shooting schedules for your live audience sitcom.
Yeah. And then we got it down to like 4 days. So we would rehearse for two, do a camera blocking, and then shoot. And those would be our 4 days. And we'd usually get Mondays off, which just became amazing because...
You know. This is a gig, everybody, because, you're maybe working 4 days a week, and then you have a week off out of every month because there needs to be a hiatus for the writer's room to basically keep up with the number of scripts that they need to have out ahead. And then you have, I don't know, how many months off of the year. So basically, you go on your long hiatus in, I don't know,
February
or March, and then you don't come back until July.
Yeah.
So it's pretty sweet.
Yeah, it's a sweet gig. Yeah. Think about working 12 days out of the month, which is what it really came down to.
Yes.
I mean, when you were a kid and you're in school, then it's a different story. But as an adult, I look back on that, I'm like, oh, I gotta get on a multicam.
Yeah. It's amazing. And then some of the shows get down to 3-day weeks.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's insane.
So what do you think? Shall we wrap it up?
Yeah, let's wrap it up. Well, thanks for joining us this week. Next week, we will be on to season 1, episode 3 of Step by Step, and I'm sure more antics and bad fashion will ensue.
For sure.
I'm Christine Lakin.
I'm Stacey Keenan.
And thanks for listening to us.
Thank you.
See you next week.
Bye-bye. Thanks so much for listening. Be sure to like, subscribe, and leave us a review. We'd love to hear from you. Please write to us at keenanandlakin@gmail.com and follow us on social at Keenan and Lakin. We are so proud that our show is produced by the fabulous Stephen Ray Morris.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.